Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I can't believe it's time again for our weekly Q&A with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. If you haven't heard the podcast so far, Layla is the nutritionist that I work with on a daily basis at the Hoffman Center. She is a registered dietitian, and she also holds a master's degree in nutrition. So take a bow, Layla.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, great. And so what we generally do in this session, to give you the ground rules, is we accept questions from listeners and people who read our newsletter, and they can be sent to radioprogram@AOL.com. State your question, and we will endeavor to answer it on the air during one of our podcasts. So before we get to questions, I know we have a lot of them. It was announced that an additional 35 to 40 million Americans should be on statin drugs. The headline in CNN, I'm reading here, Layla, not on cholesterol meds, new guidelines may change that. And here's how it reads. It says, if you're not on a medicine to lower your cholesterol yet, you might be soon, because the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology announced just yesterday new treatment guidelines calling for more people to be on statin drugs. And I plan to do an entire podcast on the subject, so I'll let our listeners know via the usual methods, via Twitter and via Facebook, and we'll get the word out, because I want to really tackle this issue in the next few weeks. So, what's your take on this?
Oh, this is terrible. And based on any of the science, there's nothing to really support it at all. So most people over the age of 40 now are going to be on a statin. That's going to be a lot of people walking around without any joy for life, with low libido, with muscle ache. It's terrible. It's terrible.
And, you know, I think, you know, I've looked at this preliminarily, and, you know, what they're doing away with, which I think is good, is this old approach, which was sort of a paint-by-numbers approach. It gave doctors and patients specific cholesterol targets. But this was erroneous, because some people with high cholesterol don't get heart disease, and some people who have low cholesterol absolutely are at high risk for heart disease. And so they got rid of this whole thing of, you know, if your cholesterol is above whatever, or if you're specifically, they targeted LDL, low density lipoprotein, the so-called bad cholesterol, and the guidelines were, if it was above 160, you should be on a statin. If it was 130 and you had some risk factors, you should be on a statin. If it was 100 and you had more risk factors, you should be on a statin. They just completely did away with that. But in so doing, which I think is a good idea, because that system was broken. But in so doing, they have widened the net for more and more Americans to be on statins.
Which is terrible. So Big Pharma is going to be making a whole lot more money. I think it's terrible for the American public, because we're going to have more demented people by the age of 45 or 50. It's terrible.
Yeah, and I think it's exactly what America doesn't need at this time of our current healthcare crisis, and the inauguration or rollout of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, call it what you will. This means incredible new burdens placed on our healthcare system to pay for this medication, to screen people for a cholesterol-lowering medication, as if that were the primary. I have to say, I think there's some people who really legitimately need this type of medication. There's no question this medication helps people who have high risk for cardiovascular disease. So people who have...
Dr. Hoffman, generally that's a pool of men, middle-aged typically, who have already had a heart attack.
Yeah.
So it's not really for primary prevention. And we also have to look at all the side effects that can be caused. It's causing diabetes.
Yeah,
which is complete irony to me, because diabetes type 2 is almost a form of heart disease. Their arteries clog so much faster.
And ironically, under the new guidelines, under the new guidelines, it actually points out that it is imperative for all persons between the age of 40 and 75 who have type 2 diabetes to be on a statin. So it actually, it's good, which is a contradiction in terms, because now it's been demonstrated that statins may promote insulin resistance and thus worsen one's chances for type 2 diabetes. Now, they say the effect is slight. It doesn't occur that often, but if it occurs 10 or 20% of the time and we're putting tens of millions of Americans on statins, you know, imagine what a problem that's going to create. And,
yeah,
you know,
I
so,
mean, type 2 is already pandemic. Alzheimer's, which is type 3, is just behind there. So now here is another risk factor almost being on a statin to arrive at any of those chronic conditions. So now this is terrible news.
Right. So anyway, we're going to delve into this issue. You know, perhaps you and I will do a workshop on this specific issue because, you know, clearly I
excellent idea.
We're going in the wrong direction. And I think a lot of Americans are just disgusted and fed up. And once again, and by the way, these are guidelines that are purveyed by the American Heart Association, the same organization that once promoted high consumption of polyunsaturated fats, so-called heart-healthy omega-6 fats that now have been proven to be unhealthy for us. They've also inveighed against eggs and cholesterol and saturated fats in full-fat dairy, which is now proven to be a total left turn, wrong, you know, it's like a wrong direction in cardiovascular prevention. And, of course, they're the same folks who brought to us the ultra-low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, which mm-hmm. hasn't panned out either.
Exactly. So it remains to be seen. But no, you know what? You and I should do something this winter, a presentation on this whole cholesterol new guideline fiasco, I think.
Right.
I think it's warranted.
And we're going to present the data objectively and fairly because by no means is there unanimity on this issue. You know, we're not just voices in the wilderness who are eccentric. There's going to be a great deal of controversy in the medical establishment, although they have already pulled the rug out from under us before the issue has been fully aired. And I think the proposition is still controversial, yet they've now made it policy. It's official. And what worries me is that it's even going to become medically risky, or shall we say legally risky, for doctors to not prescribe statins. Doctors will stampede to prescribe statins because they're going to say, look, that's what the guidelines state. And if, God forbid, I've got a patient who, you know, bad stuff happens to patients, they get strokes, they get heart attacks, and if I haven't put that patient on a statin, you know, I may get a call from, you know, I may get a summons and complaint sent to me because of the possibility that I missed an opportunity to put the patient on a widely mm-hmm. prescribed medication. And that's going to have a very chilling effect on medical practice.
Absolutely. It's a terrible place to put doctors. It really, really is, you know. And all these guidelines are only imposing on a doctor's good clinical judgment on how to treat a patient, and it has to be individualized. All the scientific research showing anything is based on populations and cohorts, but not necessarily an individual's biochemistry. So this is very important. Doctors need to take their power back on all of this.
Yeah, you know, we're feeling kind of beat up these
yeah.
days with the, you know, Affordable Care Act coming down the pike and reimbursements dropping and all kinds of new requirements.
Yeah.
You know, the question is, you know, can you keep your doctor? It's not so much that, but will your doctor stick around as the healthcare environment gets more and more challenging to navigate? So anyway, this particular doctor, this team, you know, you and I, we will we'll keep going because,
yeah.
You know, I never did have much truck with the insurance companies and Medicare. And so hopefully I won't be drafted into action. Or be compelled to practice conventional medicine.
Well, hope by that time you may be retiring. So
okay. Well, that's yeah. 20 or 30 years down the line. I don't know.
There we go. Good.
All right. So so we have a bunch of questions. Do you have any in front of you?
Actually, I have one.
Okay.
This came over the email from Janet.
Yep.
And she says, I am currently taking the EPA fish oil. I noticed that lecithin has 11% fat and 2% saturated fat. Is all this fat plus the fat in the fish oil, good fat I know, she says, advisable to take?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is more misinformation and, you know, saturated fats are bad. This is going to take a very, very long time for that idea, or shall I call it a myth, to actually die. Lecithin in a supplement, a fish oil or any other supplement generally is used as an emulsifier.
Correct.
Fats need emulsifiers so that they blend properly. And the fact that there's any saturated fat at all is really not of issue.
Right.
Really.
So yeah, I actually am surprised to hear that, but I guess that's a possibility that even in a fish oil capsule, which is mostly omega-3 polyunsaturated fat, that there may be a little bit of saturated fat.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But that would be it's unless you're saturated fat phobic, which we've really done a good job of making people, to look at a capsule and say there's a little saturated fat in there in this beneficial fish oil capsule, and to say, oh my goodness, I've got to find a fish oil capsule that is free of any taint, any molecules, 20 milligrams of saturated fats,
yeah.
That is, succumbing to fat phobia. You know, but I will say this, and I think you would agree, is, when you put lots of omega-3 into your diet, generally it's a good idea to simultaneously reduce your carbohydrate calories, because let's say you're a type 1 diabetic, for example. Okay, type 1 diabetics require insulin. It's kind of an artificial situation. It's sort of they really have to look at calories in, calories out in terms of what their weight is going to end up being. So, I mean, it's theoretically possible that if you were to maintain your current diet, keep eating the same amount of carbohydrates, and then add, say, 9 fish oil capsules. Each has a gram of fat in it. And what's the equation in terms of the calories per gram of fat? I think
it's 9 calories per gram of fat, so, and it's 4 calories per gram of carbohydrates.
Okay, so that's not many calories, but say 9 times 6, that's another 50 plus calories that you're adding to your program. So, look to reduce, and it wouldn't be very hard to reduce 50 calories from somewhere else in the form of carbohydrates, lest you actually increase your number of calories, right?
Right, right. No, that's actually a very, very good point.
Okay. So,
and it's not just a matter of calories in, calories
exactly.
out, the type of calories, but yeah.
Do you have any other questions, Layla?
Yes, actually I do. Judy emailed us, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I'm a listener, and I'm wondering if you can answer a question. I only buy wild salmon and never farm-raised because of all the hormones and antibiotics used. Stu Leonard's has a salmon they use that is farm-raised, but no hormones or antibiotics, they say. Is that just as healthy as wild salmon, or are there other negatives to farm-raised that I'm not aware of?"
Okay, and that's an excellent question. So do you want to tackle that? Have you looked into the salmon controversy? Because it's one of the hot and heavy controversies in nutrition these days.
Totally. First of all, wild Alaskan salmon is probably the best thing that you'll ever get, because it's going to have the amount of omega-3s that are inherent to it. The thing about farm-raised, it's fine that if they don't use hormones, antibiotics, certainly it's good that if they don't use hormones or antibiotics, but it doesn't mean they feed the fish the proper way. You know, they could be feeding fish corn and soy or things other than the fish meal that they're supposed to get, which will also change their fatty acid composition.
So that's along the lines of "you are what you eat eats,"
yeah.
Right? The old saying that I've coined that phrase.
Yes, yes. The farm-raised salmon is not going to have nearly as many omega-3 fats or anything like that.
Right.
Also with the farm-raised, they're not using natural astaxanthin for the color, that nice pink color of the salmon. They're using a chemical form. The name of it escapes me,
I think it's cryptoxanthin. There's astaxanthin.
Okay.
These are pigments that are present in algae, and they work their way through the food chain into the flesh of the salmon. And the salmon that you see that is wild salmon, that's the natural color. But if not for adding these pigments, they're carotenoid-type pigments. Some people think that these are healthy. Some people are not so sure. This will actually color the grayish, unappealing-looking flesh of the fish to make it look more like wild salmon.
Yeah. So the answer is, to Judy, wild is best.
Right.
It's more expensive, but, you know, it's worth it.
And I think also another consideration, you know, wild salmon it comes from the wide ocean, and even salmon that is cultivated comes from salmon pens that are located close to coastal areas, where even if they don't add antibiotics or give hormones, there is a greater chance of local water pollution and the possibility that there may be some more PCBs in the water or in the food chain for the salmon. Although the salmon are fed are artificial pellets, they actually they're sort of like, you know how we used to feed goldfish. You know, mm-hmm. there's like a little flaky kind of thing you feed the goldfish. They actually feed some sort of pellets to the salmon that are made from, I don't know, a variety of materials. God only knows what. Hopefully, you know, higher quality ingredients. But, you know, you are what you eat.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's absolutely true.
Good answer. So, here's the problem I have. It is so darn expensive to get wild salmon. So you actually came up with a solution, and I've tried your solution, which is to go to Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's actually...
Yeah.
And this is, you know, Trader Joe's not a sponsor, but this is a suggestion for people who are, like, getting sticker shock from the wild. You know, we say, you know, you got to eat healthy, so you got to buy fresh berries and arugula and wild salmon. But, you know, that can get pretty expensive. It sounds pretty elitist to tell people to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And listen, you know, I was just at Trader Joe's last night, and I'm looking at a package of salmon right now. It's about $8.99 a pound.
That's not horrible. That's cheaper.
It's cheaper
than the so-called farmed organic salmon, you know,
absolutely,
which is what she's talking about. Which, by the way, and when I don't buy wild, I try to get the farmed organic salmon. But keep in mind that there is no law, there is no regulatory agency, or no very specific definition for organic fish. So it's a self-applied appellation. You can appropriate that appellation to your product, and basically it's on the honor system. So, you know, what you have there is so-called organic. You know, they did a study, and I think it was published in the New York Times a couple of years ago, and what they found was that even at some pretty reputable stores, they did a survey in Manhattan. What they found was that some salmon that was branded wild Alaskan fresh, you know, coho and sockeye, was actually farmed salmon that just got, you know, was counterfeit.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's a lot of counterfeit seafood. Apparently there's no such thing as white tuna. There's something being called white tuna.
Yeah.
For people who want more information on all of this, first of all, they should go to environmentalworkinggroup.org.
EWG.org. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also another great website for mercury, if you're concerned about mercury in your seafood, and we all are, of course, go to gotmercury.org. That's gotmercury.org. It's a very, very user-friendly
site. Yeah, it's a counter, and it tells you, you know, based on the amount and type of fish, how much of your safe monthly allocation of mercury you're obtaining. Of course, you know, no mercury is really safe, but there's a threshold where there's less toxicity, and I think it's virtually impossible to find something that is completely bereft of any toxic substances anymore in this world.
We're walking around, most of us are walking around with some level of some toxic substances, even from things that have been banned in the 1970s. I mean, even the days of leaded fuel, you know, a source of lead. These things are still persist in the environment. They don't necessarily go away. So.
Yep. All right,
we
do the best we can.
Well.
We detox.
Yep.
You know, we can offer people chelation therapy, which we often do. I just saw, as you know, we saw a gentleman in our office yesterday, a very nice French gentleman who came in, and he had, unbeknownst to him, he had extraordinarily high levels of mercury. And part of the reason was he had lived in Japan. His job had assigned him to live in Japan for about 4 or 5 years. And his levels of mercury were so high that he was notified by the health department, because it's actually reportable when somebody is diagnosed as having AIDS or gonorrhea or syphilis or high mercury or high lead, there's an automatic notification to the health department. And then they call you up and they say, what's up with you? How come you're so high in mercury. So, and this is not a guy, an industrial worker. He didn't work in a, you know, in a, some sort of battery factory or someplace where they make mercury containing light bulbs. He was just a citizen who was eating, well, you know, frequently enjoyed sushi, and he had enormously high levels.
Sushi could be the other culprit, of course. That dental amalgams.
He had his fillings. Yes, he had his fillings.
Yeah, and certainly, yeah, living in Japan for a few, that could do it too. Even places like China, we've heard from other people as well. So, yeah, chelation is good. Yeah.
So that's what we'll do with him. Okay, so I have a question, which is from Eileen. Eileen writes, my 38-year-old daughter was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. Is there anything natural she can take? Thank you, Eileen.
Ah, wow. Well, first of all, there are many natural things she could take, but, you know, we would want to know the cause of the rheumatoid arthritis, why it started, and especially at her age, you know, what was the preceding event. And the kind of things that we would look at would be, A, for gluten sensitivity or even outright celiac disease, if possible. And there is a nutrition gold standard for treating autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis. It's the elimination of gluten, and it's the elimination of casein. Casein is the protein found in all dairy products. That dairy products is any food made from an animal's milk. People mistakenly think eggs are dairy. But they're in the dairy aisle in the grocery store. I keep making this distinction.
Right.
Eggs are meat. They're
right.
Not dairy.
So right.
Dairy is anything made from an animal's milk. That's milk, cheese, ice cream, yogurt, and butter as well. So
right.
Those would be the first things to look at. But we have some wonderful supplements.
Yes. Do you want to start or do you want me to weigh in? Let me start.
No, you weigh in.
Yeah, we'll do a little duet on this because I really like treating rheumatoid arthritis. Not that it's not a challenging condition because I find that patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis, it takes time. It takes 6, 12, 18 months, up to 2 years for them to resolve. And so it requires patients. Sometimes, under my supervision, they actually do require medication, you know, because you got to put the fire out. It's a very devastating disease, and we don't want patients to become deformed, you know, with crippled hands and feet. Before our very eyes. So, but diet with certain supplements will ultimately turn it around, either in part or sometimes remarkably total remission. So, okay.
I forgot to make one more point about dietary elimination.
Yeah.
That's the nightshades.
Okay.
The nightshade, it's imperative, especially in arthritis. And the nightshades are tomatoes, peppers, all peppers, white potatoes, eggplant, and tobacco. People are very surprised when I say tobacco. So even if you're not a smoker, you also want to be sure that you're not around any secondhand smoke if you're suffering with arthritis. So anyway, on to the supplements.
Right. We might amplify a little bit on the diet part because for people who are real stalwarts, you know, they're super motivated. And, I don't see how you can be anything other than motivated if you have a severe disease like rheumatoid arthritis. But some people, they don't want to be inconvenienced. They say, look, I'd rather take some medication, you know, whatever. But if you really want to go for it, it's the paleo diet. The paleo diet, I think, is an extraordinary tool for dealing with autoimmune disease. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
Which goes beyond that. It includes, of course, gluten elimination and dairy elimination. What else?
But it goes farther. It eliminates the legumes. It eliminates yeasted foods. Generally, all the foods that are new to civilization, and when we say new to civilization, we mean, introduced 10,000 years ago. Agriculture, dairy, all of that, yeasted foods and so forth, beans, lentils, all of that. All of these are eliminated to help the immune system to return to a better state, a more to modulate the immune system. Vitamin D is also critically important.
Right. And, vitamin D actually is what I notice is that rheumatologists these days who treat rheumatoid arthritis, many of them are now routinely checking their patients for vitamin D, and they will supplement aggressively, which is really good news because I think it's finally sinking in that vitamin D is very helpful for controlling autoimmune diseases and inflammation. So we get, often they'll put patients on 50,000 once a week. We'll give patients 5,000, sometimes 10,000 a day. Because the vast majority of patients we see with rheumatoid arthritis are very low. Just a little anecdote here. My mother had rheumatoid arthritis, And I lived on the East Coast and she lived on the West Coast, so I was trying to treat her from afar. And I kept saying, "Mom, you got to get your vitamin D checked. You got to." She says, "Well, you know, Medicare won't pay for it." And I said, "Mom, I'm gonna. How much is the test? I'll send you a check. Get it checked." So finally, I called her doctor and said, "Please check her for vitamin D and send me the bill." So we checked her vitamin D, and what do you think it was, Layla?
I can guess. 12.
Yeah. No. It was worse than that. It was 7. So we know that that's a severe vitamin D deficiency. But, of course, you know, she was laid up. She felt, you know, her joints were hurting, so she stayed inside a lot of the time. And even though she lived in Southern California, you got virtually no sunlight. Her diet was low in vitamin D. So a vitamin D of 7. So ultimately, you know, we started her on vitamin D. And I can't say that it cured her rheumatoid arthritis, but it helped. So, unfortunately, it was too late because she'd walked around with such low levels for too long. So, yeah, vitamin D, very important. Other nutrients, you know, one of the things that, glucosamine chondroitin, I'm not sure is that helpful for rheumatoid arthritis. It's more helpful for osteoarthritis, but we use it anyway. We'll also use undenatured collagen type 2 or UCP type 2.
Rumishield, yes.
Which is in the product Rumishield. By the way, you know, for our listening audience, if you're unfamiliar with products like this, drhoffman.com has a full roster, and there's a product called Rumishield there that's very good for rheumatoid arthritis. Of course, there's other anti-inflammatories.
Like the
let's talk about
curcumin.
Those.
Curcumin.
Okay.
Curcumin, Boswellia, fish oil.
Right.
These are like the magic three or the top superheroes for anti-inflammatory, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
So definitely fish oil, and probably higher amounts than we would for anybody else who's just interested in health optimization.
Exactly.
Curcumin, Boswellia, ModuCare.
Yes.
ModuCare would also be very useful in helping to modulate that immune response.
Yeah, it's not a steroid, but it's a stearinol. So it has some steroid-like effects in the joints to help reduce inflammation. So ModuCare is the product. And then another one, and this you can't get, you know, online or you can't get over the counter. It's prescribed by a doctor. It's low-dose naltrexone, LDN. And it's a thing that can gently modulate the immune response. And we prescribe it. It's also used for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, and other autoimmune conditions. And even for fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue, I prescribe it. Go to lowdosenaltrexone.org or .info or just Google it, look it up, because low-dose naltrexone, NALTREXONE, is very interesting as a way of dealing with autoimmune stuff. So, I mean, there's a lot more to it. You know, we could give a weekend course on rheumatoid arthritis, but those are some of the basics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I got more. Do you have another one?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay, here's mine. This was from Nadia. Nadia writes, "Hi, is mastic gum safe to take while nursing? I look forward to your response."
Okay, let's assume Nadia has ulcer or H. pylori or something like that going on. If I may say, mastic gum, and I know it's been around. It's indigenous to Mediterranean islands historically. It's been has a lot of commercial uses dating back to the Greek Empire.
It's even used in pastry. It's a flavoring for Greek and Turkish pastry. Yeah.
Oh, I should know that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're from sort of that part of the world, right?
Right. You know what? Well, because she's nursing, and I always prefer to err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
Because everything is going to be passed through mother's milk to the baby.
Right.
So I wonder what kind of effect that might have. But what do you think, Dr. Hoffman?
Yeah, I mean, I would exercise caution, but I think it's probably pretty wholesome. Mastic gum, it's actually originated on the island of Chios, and it's a very ancient spice, and it is helpful for suppressing H. pylori and healing ulcers. So, you know, we're pretty comfortable using it, you know, even in, you know, children. And,
yes.
You know, I don't see a strong contraindication to using it. You know, of course, that would be part of an ulcer protocol. We would be using other things, right?
Right. And taking into consideration that she's nursing. So, yeah.
So, I would certainly use DGL. I don't see any problem using that.
Oh, DGL should be just fine. Yeah.
And, maybe aloe gel for the stomach. That would be fine and non-toxic. So, I'm pretty comfortable with using it. I don't think there's a big problem with it.
Okay. All right. I've got a question
here.
This is from John. He says, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Have been listening to you for years and now enjoy your podcast. I wondered your opinion on structured water. Is it worth the expense? Please let us know. Stay healthy and happy." This is actually from Tina. Yeah.
Oh, actually, we sort of answered this question before, and it was on the subject of Willard's water. All right?
Now,
Willard's water. Okay, so actually what I've done since then is John was very helpful because he sent me additional information. In fact, he sent me something that's quite interesting. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see that John posted a 20-minute long, 60 minutes segment on Willard's water, which I swear must be from like 1983 because the correspondent who did it, I recognize him. He's an old timer. He's long since dead. This is 30 years ago, and it was a very interesting segment. And what they said basically in the segment, they went to the place where Willard developed this Willard's water, and they went around interviewing people who drank it or used it, or they showed one guy who had a terrible burn and he sprayed it on his burn, and they showed people pouring Willard's water on their gardens, and their squash was record size. And it was sort of vague, non-scientific, and anecdotal. And they went into what is Willard's water. Well, Willard's water is something called structured water, which makes me suspicious already. How do you structure water? It's H2O molecules. But apparently there is some science to it because the guy who developed it was a pretty competent chemist. And what it is they put substances into the water which turn it a little bit into a surfactant. A surfactant has the ability to penetrate tissue. It has a little bit of a detergent effect. And the thought is maybe it's better absorbed. It may hydrate you better, or it may penetrate, say, if you have a burn site and you want to hydrate it, it may get in there better. When they did an analysis, they didn't find anything harmful, like residues of cadmium or arsenic or bacteria. So what they concluded at the end of this segment was maybe it's helpful. Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotal information. There's no true science. There's not been any studies. And now it's 30 years later, and there's still some people clinging to this. The locals like it a lot because maybe it's, boosts the local economy there in South Dakota where it originates from. And there's a lot of folklore around it. But I don't know. It sounds a little bit speculative to me. I mean, I gained a little bit more respect for it after the 60-minute segment. But they kind of treated it as simply like a medical curiosity, or actually a non-medical curiosity, because it kind of goes against mainstream medicine for sure.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What little research I've seen about it, it's something to do with vortex science.
Oh.
By stirring the water, by agitating it, it restructures the cells into a formation that makes it more... But it sounds like the stuff that they were adding, the surfactant or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway.
See, what you just said is, what I thought it was. I thought it was almost some sort of like electronic homeopathic rearranging or structuring of the water molecule. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff out there like that. And that stuff, I got to say, there's not a lot of science that suggests that you modify water or create some sort of chemical memory in it with some pass of an electronic wand. I don't know. That's a little too woo-woo for me. And I got to say, some people may think I'm a real stick in the mud for not, getting with the program that's, alternative and very, very...
It has to be supported by science.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be supported. Well, I'll tell you when I'll sit up and take notice. When they turn water into wine, I'll sit up and take notice.
Well, that's, as you know, that's a historical fact. I mean, that's documented.
Yeah.
It's in the Bible. And every word of the Bible we should take literally or whatever, depending on your... Okay. Okay, got it. A question. Another question. We got a lot of questions. So if you've got time.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, let me see. I just want to not be redundant here. Okay, I actually wanted to attack this subject because we talked a little bit about decaf. So this isn't a question, but I have a little more information on decaf.
Okay.
We talked in our last session about the benefits or potential harms of decaf. And so I actually have a little clarification. I think I sent you this too, from Dr. Stephen Sinatra, who has been kind enough to feature some of my articles on his website. So go to Dr. Stephen Sinatra's website and check out some of the articles that I've written for him there. But he has a lot of informative articles, and his most recent article is on, quote, the dark side of decaf coffees and a healthier alternative. So here's what he says. He agrees with us. He says, there's no question that coffee provides some valuable health benefits. He says, a recent study showed that the polyphenols in coffee can extend your life. And he says that the good news is that it's not even related to the caffeine content of the coffee. So even if you shun caffeine because it might trigger cardiac arrhythmias or elevate your blood pressure or worsens your insomnia, you can still get the same health benefits from decaf. But is switching to decaf coffee really a healthy move? And that's the issue that we tackled. And he writes that decaf coffees have a serious dark side. And that is what I referred to. Many decaf coffees are processed using methylene chloride, a known carcinogen.
Yeah.
Okay. He adds, and this is where there's a little refinement to what we said last week. He says, while there are coffees on the market labeled, quote, naturally decaffeinated, they have a downside, too. They're natural because they're decaffeinated using something else, ethyl acetate. That's a natural solvent found in pears, bananas, and other fruits. And that's interesting because, you know, there's a little acetone smell.
Ethylene gas, yes. The ripening gas.
Actually, it's
gas,
not ethylene is ethylene gas, but ethyl acetate is something that is a natural solvent that's a little bit like an ingredient that you find in glue. And you know that when you smell a ripe pear or banana, it almost has a little bit of the aroma, of sweet aroma of glue. So it says ethyl acetate occurs naturally in nature. But they use synthetic ethyl acetate in decaffeinating coffee, and that's the same chemical added to many perfumes, paint, nail polish removers, and printer's ink, you know, which has a kind of a sweet, fruity flavor, right? So the FDA has classified it as GRAS, or generally regarded as safe, but they say that some studies have shown it has an adverse effect on some animals. And so he's a little concerned with that. And he says the other problem is many decaf coffees aren't truly caffeine-free. Well, duh. U.S. guidelines state that decaf needs to be at least 97% caffeine-free. But if you're drinking a lot of it, you know, you're kidding yourself because, you know, like me, I drink, 6, 7, 8, 9 cups of decaf a day. And so if it's 3%, 3%, 3%, pretty soon you get up to, significant percentage, you know, like half a cup of real coffee. So... his suggestion, and that was our suggestion too. He talks about the Swiss water method.
Yes.
And he says that was developed in Switzerland in the 1980s. It's a proprietary 10-hour process that results in a decaffeinated coffee that is 99.9% caffeine-free. And it's very...
They basically use water.
Yeah,
they basically use water to help, remove the caffeine, which is just fine. Meanwhile, I'm going to go sniff a pear to evaluate.
Exactly. You might get
what that smells like.
Right.
That's some printer cartridges.
Exactly. I mean, there's some people like, sniffing glue. But they talk about the water process, decaf process, and they say that this has actually achieved the seal of approval of the Organic Crop Improvement Association. So it's pretty wholesome and natural. But I have to say this, it is really expensive, and the Swiss water process decaf is hard to find. So, if you're a true decaf aficionado, track down some Swiss water processed decaf, and then you'll avoid the potential toxicity.
Yeah, I think I heard someone say they found it at Zabar's.
Okay. Okay.
So that's a possibility. Okay. I can't imagine they wouldn't have it at a Whole Foods or something.
So right
like
there,
I know
it's very expensive. Right. I mean, that just.
Yeah, it's expensive. You get what you pay for, I suppose. So,
right.
Yeah.
Zabar's is expensive. Okay. And maybe you can get it online from various sources.
Mm-hmm.
So Swiss water process decaf. All right. Here's one final question. And it's a very interesting question. I don't know if we can come to an answer, but it's provocative. Dear Dr. Hoffman, in your October 30th podcast, you asked researcher and integrative oncologist Dr. Barry Boyd to comment on nutraceuticals such as EGCG and curcumin. I was surprised to hear him say that while both were of value when taken apart, they canceled each other out, providing zero benefit when taken together. I looked at my bottles of supplements and found that the two are together in your PhytoGuard formula. They're also found together in Zyflamend, which is a popular anti-inflammatory formula. Can you shed more light on this? Okay, so here's...
Okay, I have a question then.
Yeah.
There's a conundrum. Does that mean the next time I eat curry that I shouldn't have my green tea with it?
Yeah. See, okay, this is what I have to say about that, is that it is conceivably possible that that is the case. But I got to say that I think what he's talking about is some new cutting-edge scientific theory that has not yet been documented. I'm going to that's going to stay on my radar screen, and I'm going to look at that possibility. However, I don't take it as established fact. It's a little bit reminiscent of, you remember when they used to say don't take magnesium with calcium together? Because completely,
and some people still are, yes.
And it would, people would religiously avoid taking magnesium, calcium. Now, many supplement formulas, especially for osteoporosis, have both together. But there was this new idea, and people are very rigid. They take this maybe a little too seriously. They said, if I take my magnesium with calcium, it's going to totally neutralize my magnesium or my calcium. And it turned out that ultimately they did a study and they found that really wasn't the case. That the vast majority of calcium when taken with magnesium is properly absorbed and vice versa. So,
you have to think of it also in relationship to food. You know, dark green leafies comes to mind. It contains both calcium and magnesium. If it's canceling each other out, it just doesn't make all that much sense.
Yeah.
So,
just to remind people, PhytoGuard is something that I developed in the 1990s, and I'm still very proud of that formulation because it stood the test of time, because it has EGCG, curcumin, lycopene, quercetin. We added pomegranate in the mid-2000s to it. It also has a potent extract of broccoli in it. What else is that? Anything else? Am I missing? I might be missing something.
I think you've pretty much covered.
Yeah, everything but kitchen sink. And these are nutrients that we know of as anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer, potent antioxidants. So I recommend that if you're going to take a multi like our foundation formula, that you accompany it with a multi nutraceutical that's like PhytoGuard. PhytoGuard gives you everything in one easily swallowed tablet to provide you with nutrient support.
Absolutely. That way you get all your bases covered. Absolutely. Yep.
Right. So apropos, I'll mention that drhoffman.com is our website. And if you want to find out about the supplements that we talk about, please check it out. And remember that these podcasts come to you free of charge. And if you want to keep them coming, make sure you patronize the store at drhoffman.com. The prices are fair and competitive. A caveat is that we stock only the highest quality supplements with the most potent, scientifically established ingredients, so they might be a couple of bucks more expensive than at your discount drugstore. But you can be sure of quality there. And we also have a price match guarantee, so if you find the same products elsewhere on the web, the very self-same product, we'll match your price. How's that for a deal?
Excellent.
drhoffman.com. All right, so thank you very much, and I guess I'll see you in the office.
Thank you.
I will see you in the office
very good.
Tomorrow. We got a busy day in store for us, taking care of patients at the Hoffman Center. Of course, Layla available be your dietary counselor should you choose to see her individually at the Hoffman Center. Just call the center for information. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine podcast.